Okay, so we'll khandas and finish it off, maybe. So this next sutta is Samyutta 22, sutta number 94, continuing in the Khanda Samyutta. It's Avati. Bhikkhus, I do not dispute with the world. Rather, it is the world that disputes with me. A proponent of the Dhamma does not dispute with anyone in the world. Of that which the wise in the world agree upon as not existing, I too say that it does not exist. And of that which the wise in the world agree upon as existing, I too say that it exists. And what is it, bhikkhus, that the wise in the world agree upon as not existing, of which I too say that it does not exist? Form that is permanent, stable, eternal, not subject to change, this the wise in the world agree upon as not existing, and I too say that it does not exist. Feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, that is permanent, stable, eternal, not subject to change, this the wise in the world agree upon as not existing, and I too say that it does not exist. That, bhikkhus, is what the wise in the world agree upon as not existing, of which I too say that it does not exist. And what is it, bhikkhus, that the wise in the world agree upon as existing, of which I too say that it exists? Form that is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change. This the wise in the world agree upon as existing, and I too say that it exists. Feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, that is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, this the wise in the world agree upon as existing, and I too say that it exists. That, bhikkhus, is what the wise in the world agree upon as existing, of which I too say that it exists. There is, bhikkhus, a world phenomena in the world to which the Tathagata has awakened and broken through. Having done so, he explains it, teaches it, proclaims it, establishes it, discloses it, analyzes it, elucidates it. And what is that world phenomena in the world to which the Tathagata has awakened and broken through? Form, bhikkhus, is a world phenomenon in the world to which the Tathagata has awakened and broken through. Having done so, he explains it, teaches it, proclaims it, establishes it, discloses it, analyzes it, elucidates it. When it is being thus explained, elucidated by the Tathagata, if anyone does not know and see, how can I do anything with that foolish worldling, blind and sightless, who does not know and does not see? Feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, is a world phenomenon in the world to which the Tathagata has awakened and broken through. Having done so, he explains it, teaches it, proclaims it, establishes it, discloses it, analyzes it, elucidates it. When it is being thus explained, taught, proclaimed, established, disclosed, analyzed, and elucidated by the Tathagata, if anyone does not know and see, how can I do anything with that foolish worldling, blind and sightless, who does not know and does not see? Because just as a blue, red, or white lotus is born in the water and grows up in the water, but having risen up above the water, it stands unsullied by the water, so too the Tathagata was born in the world and grew up in the world, but having overcome the world, he dwells unsullied by the world. So that there's a couple things that are interesting in this sutta. One is the that there's a of course there's inevitable philosophical speculations and debates and writhings and contortions that go around the what truly exists, what is not exists, the eternalist views, the annihilationist views, and about the world, and it's sort of all is very externalized and speculative, and the Buddha sort of heads it off at the pass and says, when we're going to talk about what exists and what doesn't exist, is the world real? Is the world an illusion? Is it all real? Is it all an illusion? Come back to these five khandhas, which are the basis of experience, and where we formulate our perceptions and views, and this is what we can recognize and understand, and this is what is, of course, the basis for freedom from suffering. And then the word world phenomenon is lokadhamma, which is also when the Buddha says, there are these lokadhammas, there's another context that comes up in praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, those aspects, those are lokadhammas. But it's also, this is another slightly different context. Bhikkhu Bodhi's opted to translate it as a world phenomenon, sort of that which is appearing in the world, and to which the Buddha has awakened and broken through, and I think the Buddha is really trying to make it as straightforward as possible, and so then they say, having explained it, taught it, proclaimed it, elucidated it, and people don't see, what can I do about it? And of course, then finishing with that image of the lotus, and said that the Buddha was not some celestial being that is or an avatar of some celestial being that is manifesting in the world. He's somebody who's born in the world and dies in the world, but being, having been born in the world, growing up in the world, remains unsullied by the world through knowledge. So I think it's a very beautiful sutta.
Transcending
sankhara
as volitional formation.
Transcending?
Translate
sankhara
as volitional formation.
Uh-huh, yeah.
If you want to talk about that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he's trying to make a distinction between because the sankhara in the khandhas has a particular meaning, and of course the meaning is around the, because sankhara literally means constructed, fabricated, formulated, formed, come into being with different parts, and then in the context of the five khandhas, then sankhara are the formations of thought that are, and its distinguishing characteristic is volition, intention, thought and emotion. Loving kindness is a volitional formation, anger is a volitional formation, mindfulness is a volitional formation, wisdom is a volitional formation. Restlessness and worry is a volitional formation. So these are in terms of the context of the five khandhas, the use of volitional formation is that trying to get the context of both the that a sankhara is something that is fabricated, constructed, but it's a thought construction, and the thought is also generated through volition and intention.
Yeah.
Emotions included in that, which is different. Say say like vedana as feeling, is not feeling as emotion, but feeling as kind of like affect, tone, the feeling tone of an experience. So that when you something that is painful, pleasant, or neutral. So it's something that is very basic in the realm of cognition and experience, whereas the realm of emotion is happiness and joy, or sorrow and lamentation, grief and despair. Those are volitional formations. So the next one. So this is Samyutta 22.1.22. On one occasion, the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Mahakotita were dwelling at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. Then in the evening, the Venerable Mahakotita emerged from seclusion, approached the Venerable Sariputta, exchanged greetings, and said to him, "Friend Sariputta, what are the things that a virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to?" "Friend Kotita, a virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to the five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a dart, as misery, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as non-self." What five? "The form aggregate subject to clinging, the feeling aggregate subject to clinging, the perception aggregate subject to clinging, the volitional formations aggregate subject to clinging, the consciousness aggregate subject to clinging. A virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent," so on and so forth, "as non-self. When, friend, a virtuous bhikkhu carefully attends thus to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of stream entry." "But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu, who is a stream enterer, should carefully attend to?" "Friend Kotita, a bhikkhu who is a stream enterer should carefully attend to these five aggregates as subject to clinging, as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a dart, as misery, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as non-self. When, friend, a bhikkhu who is a stream enterer carefully attends thus to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of once returning." "But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu who is a once-returner should carefully attend to?" "Friend Kotita, a bhikkhu who is a once-returner should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent," and the same thing all over again, "as non-self. When, friend, a bhikkhu who is a once-returner carefully attends thus to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of non-returning, anagami. But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu who is a non-returner should carefully attend to?" And of course it goes through exactly the same thing. "When, friend, a bhikkhu who is a non-returner carefully attends thus to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of arahantship. But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu who is an arahant should carefully attend to?" "Friend Kotita, a bhikkhu who is an arahant should carefully attend to these five aggregate subjects, the clinging as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a dart, as misery, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as non-self. For the Arahant friend, there is nothing further that has to be done, and no repetition of what he has already done. However, when these things are developed and cultivated, they lead to a pleasant dwelling in this very life, and to mindfulness and clear comprehension. So that, there's we have our tools for us for whatever level of practice that we're at. And it's not it's actually not very complicated. So that that sense of the paying attention to these aggregates of clinging in a particular way, those reflections, turning to dispassion, disenchantment, we would do freedom.
This is a great teaching because it's in stark contrast to what many people know of Tibetan Buddhism.
Yeah, this secret teaching and that secret teaching, and then, and if you miss that secret teaching, you're totally out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's really you see how the there's a difference between the way that the Buddha. And as you see that in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where he really says, I never taught with the closed fist of a teacher. And that those secret teachings, the esoteric tradition that is for the inner circle and the outer circle, and it just didn't exist. There's this truth. And it's in that previous sutta where the Buddha sort of saying that, he's awoken and broken through to this truth, and then having done so, he explains it, he teaches it, he proclaims it, establishes it, discloses it, analyzes it, elucidates it. And it's just this, is such a wonderful, example in the history of religion and philosophy on the planet. Yes. Storytelling? No. It weaves together experience.
I can see that it's very similar to what Sakara
does. No, very different.
Yeah.
Very different in the sense of the, as you said, I mean, it's conjoined, it's not disjoined.
Mm-hmm.
But, there's a very different function for because of the presence of volition in sankhara. The actual creating of the story. Of course, the story needs to have these snippets of experience that are drawn together. Yes. Right. There's not that same kind of volition going. So,
With emotion, the question about that being a samskara is that you experience one of the experience the physical sensations in the body, and then the volition you actually say this is what anger is, and I'm angry.
No, anger is a volitional formation.
And that's but it's formed. So actually, the actual sense, physical sensations in the body, and that's sort of that formation.
No. You must be a disciple of Goenka. One is the, how do you say, there is the physical experience, and again, this is where it's so important that it's conjoined and not disjoined, so that and these are all happening together, and it's very difficult to parse it all out into really discrete aspects of these khandhas. The anger is an emotion that is formulated. The anger has a effect on the physiological level, which we then can note as pleasant or unpleasant, and then that's a trigger for emotion around that or reaction around that, which is another volitional formation. So it's all feeding back and forth, but it is somewhat different, in the sense that the experience would be slightly different, and that body and mind interaction.
Thinking how complex emotion is, it's not just sort of you saying it's not a single,
right?
A combination of that feeling, the body, the volition brought it, and even verbal thoughts, can get entangled into the whole.
Emotional weave. Yes. And then it affects the body, and then the body has a particular way of reacting, which then is then picked up differently by, say, cultural conditioning. Even there's a lot going on. Just think if they've done tests on one is, of course, the reaction in the body of say anger, and then what the hormones that are stimulated, your limbic system kind of washing your body in endocrines they've taken different say like the in America people who are from the southern states, which have and started with actually with a kind of a world culture of looking at cultures that are pastoral based, and they have a more of a kind of a warrior culture, and then that's translated into modern times of kind of honor culture. But then that the southern states in America were mostly populated by, in the early days, populated by northern Scotland, northern areas, which have more of a pastoral kind of base. So then it ended up, so there's more of a kind of an honor mindset in the south, which translates into more revenge killings and interesting family gatherings. they did these tests of going into a psych lab in some place in Michigan, I think it's in the north, and they're going in. There have been volunteers to go into the psych lab to do some psychological testing, and they come up in the elevator and go to the floor, and then they come out of the elevator, and then some kind of big hulking guy, and the sort of the test is actually already, this is the test. Some big hulking guy comes walking past them, and bumps into them, and sort of walks away from them. So watch it, asshole. And then so they go into the lab, and people from northern states and people from southern states. Very totally different ways of what their bodies were doing, how long it took for the kind of stress hormones to subside, for the different types of indicators of anger and emotion took a lot longer to subside. And this is a very interesting. These are many, and say like the Buddha is from a warrior culture, he's sort of sussed that out. This is something that's complex, but it can be dealt with and worked with. Understood. Yeah.
Can you clarify the point about Sankara being translated as volitional formations? I presume it's the same volition that's involved with the initial karma.
Yeah.
So even something which is below the level of sort of direct awareness, because you're not paying attention to it.
Yes.
And even though it's maybe not even voluntary, it's getting that transition.
Yes.
It's still
karma producing. Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Which is just in that last, even if it's, the thoughts and the feelings are moving through, there's results that come from that. And people say and do things without really being able to see clearly or understand. But the volition is there. So it's a different, again, I sort of mentioned that, the difference between that use of the word intention and volition. Because that investment in the volition, that moving forward, even if one isn't totally aware or in control of that, it still has power and has a... we reap the fruits of it.
So just to maybe think a little further, since the a lot of volitional formations are happening at this kind of conditioning and not fully aware level because of contact, right?
Mm-hmm.
Someone bumps into you and you get angry. You're not sort of deciding to get angry.
That's one of the things that they're really start, because they're starting to do a lot of these tests now. It's obviously their pool is pretty limited, but they're a lot of with this. What are the brain science that they're doing? Trying to get how people who have actually trained their minds. How do they react? And it's shaking up mind science, because it's beyond. And that was something that His Holiness actually. This is quite a few years ago. Whereas holiness actually made a suggestion to like a pioneer in that field, Richie Davidson, of why don't you research the results of virtue? Why don't you research the minds of people who are or have some peace and compassion and see what? Because the whole field has been dominated by pathologies of what's actually wrong with the mind. I mean, it's the whole kind of the big textbook on psychiatry is all about what can go wrong with the mind, and there's not much actual literature on what happens when you actually train a human mind. So that there are choices that can be made very early in that reactive process that undermine that those reactions or don't take. And that's actually Ajahn Kunodamo left kind of a couple optional suttas which he said sort of, well, this is the last one, but there's a couple, and I looked and sort of okay, I think. And it's the suttas around kind of unestablished or unsupported consciousness, which are interesting to look at as a possibility in human consciousness.
So one of the many questions.
Yeah.
The volitions that are involved in unintended, sort of unconsciously intended emotion, like an angry reaction.
Right.
Obviously, it seems like that because of prior conditioning, that was intentional, intentionally cultivating states of loving kindness, it's possible to short circuit.
Yes.
The anger reaction.
Yes. Yes.
But the chain reaction itself is caught up with, let's say, volitions that aren't at the level of direct apprehension.
Right.
The person who's experiencing them.
Right.
So most people are kind of walking around having all kinds of intentions not to be ultimate.
Yes. Yes.
So when the intentions cross the threshold between sort of like an interior mental event that's being experienced, and just using that as justification to do something or to say something,
mm-hmm.
is there a distinction between the intentions?
The comic weight is yes, there is the comic weight of something that is not fully formulated, not clearly seen is not as karmically potent as a fully formed intentions, like acting on seeing anger. Really identifying with that anger and acting on in a really, say, vengeful or spiteful way is much more karmically potent. That being said, there's also where the Buddha points to one of the because then, say that the effect is very can be quite disastrous. But it's, and this is where the Buddha said, like that, with the three roots, greed, hatred, and delusion. The results of greed are not so bad, but it takes a long time. It takes a lot to undermine that. In terms of freeing oneself from greed, the results of anger are really bad, but it's easier to relinquish that as a root within the mind. Whereas like delusion, the results are bad and it's really hard to deal with. And of course, that's where the realm of maybe not fully formed, intended actions, intended consequences, are in more in the realm of kind of delusion and ignorance.
Unpersonalized,
yeah, yeah, and it's just, you know, so you're awash in a kind of a sea of confusion. Well, sometimes it's not so subtle, but it's not it's not so it's not so nasty, you know.
Not so damaging to others.
Yeah, it's not so damaging to others. It's not so it doesn't seem so egregious, so that you know, it's a bit you know, one doesn't see the harm in it as clearly.
Also, this the greed is kind of the pleasure, whereas anger is
yes.
painful.
Yes.
And so it's easier to let go of something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's that whatever way you cut it, it's painful. And where greed is you can find some logic to support it.
That's a really useful way of getting rid of anger. I know a monk who had a lot of anger, and what he overcame was he just for a few months he just reflected on all the downsides of anger and how really it wasn't painful. That reflection was
It's really, it's just so difficult to justify.
So you realize that if your greedy actions are actually based on anger, and you know,
that's a tough one, yes. And it happens. Okay.